Here we go again.
It's time to talk.
I thought it was April Fool's Day when I heard that one. Get me off the air before I have a heart attack. We will have nothing to see for it. There's been many false dawns.
The Neil Prendeville Show on Red FM.
The kindness of Cork people who never let you down.
Conversation that matters.
So be part of the conversations that matter. The Neil Prendeville Show with Mercedes-Benz Cork, and talking about movement and motor cars. There's been an accident between 2 Mile Inn in Middleton and Lochaderra. The Lake Road is now closed to traffic. It's a bad crash. Diversions are in place and emergency services are at the scene. And when you talk about moving vehiculars, there's been a fairly alarming increase in the amount of cars on a road. 440,000 more cars on the road, but 400 fewer Gardaí policing our roads. And this clearly is unacceptable for everybody. Now, that's a front page we're making the Mail today. Nearly 500,000 more cars, 400 fewer Gardaí. More cars on the road. I know that population has increased. They're looking at, you know, over the analysis over 15 years was 440,000 more vehicles. I suppose there's more people living here. More people have come out of here. Maybe people have got slightly more affluent in many regards, and there's no longer kind of the average one-car family. It could be certainly a two-car family. And if you have, you know, more adult children living at home, it could be even maybe three, perhaps even four. But anyway, it's fairly alarming, the number of licensed vehicles on the road up. We now have over 2.9 million licensed vehicles on our roads. And maybe that's why the damage on our roads and the pounding of our roads is as bad as it's ever been. If you move then from, say, roads, I saw a story in the Examiner this morning to do with footpaths. Things are so bad now at City Council that they just don't have the money now. They find it for daft things, right? And big, huge spends. I mean, no disrespect now to the work being done in Bishop Lucy Park, but 30 million, I mean, come on. Sean Martin wants them to take out a loan for 10 million to fund footpath repairs because they don't have the cash. So City Council officials have agreed to consider drawing down a loan. I mean, you really are in big trouble if you have to take out loans because they obviously incur an interest payment or whatever. Ted Tynan says, tragedy was averted recently when faulty brickwork at a pedestrian crossing caused two wheelchair users to tumble as a bus was approaching. When I see the word tumble, I'm assuming that the people in the wheelchair tumbled out of the wheelchairs and could have been run down by an oncoming bus. I mean, that's pretty scary stuff. And without wanting to overly doom and gloom you, but the papers do it quite well. Like, we've got all sorts of health issues going on here. Do you know that we have radiation machines that are lying idle because they don't have the staff qualified to actually use them? The Health Committee heard this yesterday, and the Irish Cancer Society are freaking over these machines. These are life-saving machines. And then, of course, we got all sorts of issues with regards to, addiction. And it isn't necessarily just alcohol anymore, or the myriad of different type of drugs that we all know of. There's a new one on the way now. I'll probably mispronounce it. The Examiner talks about it on its front page this morning. Even Joe Biden's administration are warning about Xlazine. Now, this is a drug that's usually used by vets to sedate big animals. So when it's used by humans, of course, this is it's a zombie drug. They call it Trank, and it's on the way to Ireland. And the problem with these things, of course, is that they're cheap as chips. And then across the water, there's a story, a sad story in the front of the UK Times today, where a student died after extreme use of laughing gas or nitrous oxide, primarily used in catering, but unfortunately abused more these days. 24-year-old Ellen Mercer took 3 600-gram bottles of nitrous oxide a day and sniffed it. Now, the regular ones that people sniff are 8-gram bottles. They're little metal canisters. So she actually sniffed on a daily basis the equivalent of 225 regular 8-gram metal canisters of nitrous oxide. And it killed her. And that's a front pager. So you see how it's just going from bad to worse. Another issue then, and this is probably not unrelated to parking or driving or cars on our roads. One which I'll deal with later on is the ever-increasing criticism, concern about lack of parking at the railway station. But it's like a bus. When one of those stories come along, two of them come along. So we go from the railway station to Cork Airport. There was a lot of annoyance when Cork Airport introduced this 15-minute set-down limit. And after that, you'd get to pay for the next, you know, hour or what have you, something like, you know, €3. But, and you could kind of understand it because people were abusing it. But now they've decided that they're going to reduce the 15-minute set-down to a 10-minute set-down at Cork Airport. So you're free for 10 minutes. So they've knocked ahead in it. They've knocked it by a third. And it's, you know, particularly if you're an elderly person or you're slow on your feet and you need to get in and out, or you're waiting for somebody inside to come out and they might be slow on their feet, you really are running the risk of going over this 10 minutes. God knows you'd have gone over the 15. So those dropping or collecting passengers will now be charged €3 if they remain in the set down area for longer than 10 minutes. So like 10, like if they're 11 minutes, then it's €3. This 5-minute reduction. The tariff amendment came in on the 1st of April. So those who remain in the set down from 11 to 20 minutes will be charged €3. It'll go to a fiver if it's up to 30 minutes. And up to a tenner then for up to an hour. You can accept that, though, the longer periods of time, because you have no reason to be up there for that long. But, you know, I think, is it a bit mean-spirited to go from 15 to 10? Your thoughts on that are welcome. Lots to text 0868104106. We'll be coming back to those stories later on this morning. We have a junior minister on Leith side. Of course, it is Colm Burke. An opportunity to chat with him a little later on. One of the things that he has to tackle straight away is an injection centre for Cork. It will happen. It's a case of where it will happen and when it will happen. But the Mail takes a look at his career this morning, and I'll chat him a little bit later. But after Simon Harris became Taoiseach, and there was a lot of people invited there because there was a lot of pomp and ceremony about it. I had been wondering whether the drink, I had some people there actually that I knew were invited up from Cork for the whole event. And I was wondering, was the Dáil bar heaving? And one of my buddies said, no, actually, it's very, very quiet. I can now understand why, because an awful lot of them decamped to pubs around Dublin. Now, one story that's in the news this morning in the Star, Sinn Féin went on a rant yesterday because Simon Harris wasn't there for leaders' questions. Apparently, he was too busy on the phone with the Ukrainian president and other people like that. And it would appear that Sinn Féin, in particular Mary Lou McDonald, took that as a personal insult to the opposition and the people of Cork. But where were they after the inauguration, for want of a better term? Well, there was a lot of ministerial cars were spotted outside the nearest pub to Áras an Uachtaráin after Tuesday's swearing-in. There was a line of state mercs outside Ryan's of Parkgate Street. And of course, all of them wouldn't have been driven by the ministers or the junior ministers or the super ministers. They would have had their own drivers. So they were in Coffin Pints or whatever it is they were having themselves. Maybe they were cracking open bottles of champagne while the ministerial mercs were outside for them. Didn't look good. There's a photograph of it in the Red Tops tonight. It doesn't look good. The optics aren't great with it, you know. Mercs outside pubs, mercs and perks, I suppose. And then two newspapers, they're actually owned by Reach PLC, The Star and The Mirror. That's why The Star and The Mirror are pretty much identical newspapers these days. You read one and the other and they're pretty much almost the very same. I suppose none of my business, but both of them carry the same front headline yet again. And that is the fact that there is €1 million a month being spent now to home Ukrainian pets in Ireland. So if you're to believe that statistic, there it is in black and white, that's €12 million a year looking after Ukrainian pets. The state paid up to €1 million a month for pets of Ukrainian war refugees to be cared for in Ireland. The bill also includes pets that were only acquired after they arrived here. So the bill also includes pets that were only acquired here after arrival. What does that mean? Does that mean that these were pets that Ukrainians got in Ireland as opposed to pets that only came exclusively from Ukraine? Money gone to the dogs, they're saying in the papers today, as if things weren't bad enough with all of that. We're going to have a big overhaul now of the asylum system. It's very difficult to follow it. It's very confusing as to exactly how it's going to change. They're saying that it will harden our borders. And the problem with this was trying to get all European Union countries to agree with it. So more on that in a few minutes' time as well. But you talk about people who come over here for a better life. There was a Croatian lad who was battered to death for not speaking English. He obviously passed away from his injuries. It's awfully sad. There's been, at this stage now, there's been no arrests over the death of the 31-year-old Joseph Strock. But the papers this morning say that the lad who was killed for not speaking English then went on to save 4 lives by having his organs donated. And that, of course, led to people who were on organ donor lists receiving his organs. It's awfully sad. But even in death, of course, he saved 4 lives. And There's going to be a life lost at the Grand National if things go from bad to worse. Remember last year, they said in This Morning Sun, there were idiots protesting at last year's Grand National. They were trying to, weren't they trying to glue themselves at the time, if I remember correctly, to the fences. So there's going to be an awful lot more security. They call it a ring of steed, the front of the Sun today, because the Grand National is only days away, because they don't want to repeat that kind of chaos or that kind of danger. And as RTE, or at least Kevin Backhurst, tries to prevent RTE from repeating all of the stuff that got him into all that big trouble in the past, the Sun this morning says that from now on, RTE staff have to declare any gift that they get between the values of 50 to 100 euro. They have to register it on a register of gifts. And they've also been told that they're not allowed to accept any gift that's worth 100 euro or more. They should not be accepted, they should be declined, or they should be returned. So he really is going into the minutiae and the detail, particularly when it comes to freebies. And of course, if we win the Eurovision, and the chances of it, according to the Mirror this morning, are quite slim and getting slimmer. But if we were to win it, it would be a big cost to RTE and the national purse. Now, I know yesterday we spoke about whether or not Israel should be booted out of the Eurovision like Russia has, or whether Bambi Thug should actually go to Eurovision. But the Eurovision hopeful Bambi Thug has become an outsider now. Bookies are backing Switzerland. And the bookies don't usually get it wrong. They can from time to time. I hope they did, because Bambi Thug is now 33-1 to win the song contest, despite a flurry of attention for the star earlier in the year when the song came out and they won first. But 33-1 at this stage, according to the bookies. And the papers also this morning say that remote working is here to stay. It's either remote working or hybrid working. But like, one of the interesting things is that people are so into remote working now that more than half the people would turn down a new job if it didn't offer some kind of hybrid working. You know, a little bit in the office or a little bit on location and the rest of it at home, or complete and utter remote working. They seem to like it. I'd love to know the reasons why. I suppose that one of them, of course, is that there's huge savings, you know, with regards to transport and lunches and stuff like that. Also, maybe you can just set your own agenda as to when you are working at home, take better breaks, do it in blocks or whatever. One thing I see, because I have an email on it later on this morning, is some chap is saying that he works in people's homes a lot because he's a tradesman. He sees people working from home, but he says that as he's going about, he sees people working longer at home than they ever would have done in the office. You know, he could be doing a job in a house and he could be there at 7 o'clock in the morning and wouldn't be knocking off until 5 or 6. And he says they literally are working every hour God sent between those two times. And that can't be right. You have to also feel sorry for Trevor's, although I feel sorry for Karen's as well. So I think Karen's and Trevor's get a fairly bad rap. So much so for Trevor's that a bloke with the name of Trevor, a fellow called Trevor Cunningham, he's in his 60s now. He's so fed up with the negativity surrounding his name that he has set up a support group for other Trevors. He says that he wants to get rid of this maligned moniker being linked to Trevors as being geeks and nitwits. And he's got hundreds of people following him. Now, you might remember back in the day, Trevor was mocked in Ian Dury's song, Clever Trevor. In the Bisto ad from way back along, is Trevor ever getting up? Never in a month of Sundays. I don't know whether Trevor was being mocked there. But there were only like 5 or 6 Trevors names given in Ireland in the last year. So it's not a very popular name anymore. But if you are a Trevor, I'd love to hear from you as to whether you get grief over your name, whether people think you are a geek or a nitwit, that you regret being called Trevor. What's life like for Trevors? Text 0868104106. And as we continue to talk about the refund system, where you bring back your plastic and bring back your cans to get a few bob or get a voucher for it to spend in the supermarket, you bring it back to. There was an interesting one sent to me by Yorick last night, and it was a photograph of Carrick Glen Still Irish Spring Water. They're only sold in a multi-pack, which means you have to buy 12 bottles. They're 500 ml bottles, so the cost of them is €3.65. All right, but because they're great value and there's 12 of them, there's a €1.80 deposit on them. So this is a typical example of prices can go way up when you're buying multi-packs, because the 180 is the equivalent to a 50% deposit on the price. When you look at it like that, the whole thing is absolutely daft, really. It's just got so damn expensive. Anyway, text 0868104106. Traffic update for you. Breakdown at the tunnel westbound and traffic's at a standstill. So bear that in mind if you're backed up. That's the reason why the tunnel is very, very busy because of a breakdown. And also, thank you to Jack L in studio yesterday. We gave away 3 sets of 2 tickets for his gig in May. Paul Murphy in Frankfield, Joe McGrath in Cove, and Geraldine Kilfoyle in Blarney off to the Jack L gig at the Opera House.
Text or WhatsApp Neil now. 0868 104 106.
The Neil Prendeville Show on Red FM.
Pick up the phone also. 0818 104 106. Lots to do this morning because we've been covering an awful lot of different stories, but I want to see if I can demystify whatever it is that is happening at European level with regards to this new asylum system. I watched a show last night on Virgin called Is Ireland Full? They looked particularly at the beginning of the show very much at Killarney, and then they looked at places like Roscrea, Ballinrobe, Galway, Dublin, the tents in Dublin. They looked at the rioting in Dublin, where there was absolute mayhem up there, and they went into quite a lot of detail in that regard. They also spoke about the amount of empty state buildings around the country that could have been used, as opposed to, say, in Killarney, where 40% of their tourist beds are gone. They're saying that really the tourist season for this year has been written off. Nationally, 1 in 5 hotel and bed and breakfast beds are gone. You can't really blame those that have flipped over to refugees and to Ukrainian war refugees, because they take the check. They get 100% occupancy all year. It's excellent for them. The problem, of course, in the towns and villages that they're, you know, in, is that the restaurants and the bars and everything else suffers. Very interesting point was made in the show last night then that spoke about the knock-on effects to, say, schools, trying to get a GP place, hospital pressures and chaos. And perhaps that's maybe one of the reasons why the Independent this morning is saying that cancer surgeries are cancelled due to hospital overcrowding, because we have more and more people coming into Ireland, because really our border controls are recklessly weak as it stands, and maybe that's what the European Union are trying to tighten up on. But anyway, MEP Billy Callagher for Ireland South joins me by WhatsApp from where are you, Billy? Are you in Brussels?
I'm in Brussels, Neil.
Okay. So, quick question. Do you think Ireland is full?
Well, I mean, there's huge pressures on. There's no point in saying otherwise. There's huge pressure on because we have, a huge number of people that came in a very short space of time from Ukraine because of the war. We have an increasing population ourselves. We have a huge number of returning people to Ireland. Our population has gone from, 4.7 or 8 million only a few short years ago to 5.2, 5.3 million. So there is a significant increase in the population. And yes, there's increased numbers of people coming in either for applying for asylum or coming in as economic migrants as well. So yes, it is a significant challenge, and that's why this particular proposal...
No, but that's not the question. It's a significant challenge, but have we taken as much as we can, and do we now cry halt?
Well, you can't cry halt for every individual coming in. I mean, like, the people come in for lots of reasons. Some are coming in applying for asylum. Some are coming in on work permits. Some are coming in as economic migrants. Others are returning people from the rest of the European Union. So, I mean, they're entitled to come in there. They could be returning Irish people or European
citizens. But you know I'm not talking about returning Irish people. Yes, don't put them in the mix now.
No, but Neil, the issue here, you asked me a question,
Well, it's either yes or no. You haven't answered it.
Well, the point is the population is increasing dramatically. The number of people that are coming in on the asylum process, is small in the overall terms, but it is a significant challenge to deal with. So, I mean, that's why this particular proposal with regard to the European Union around the Migration Asylum Pact that was just voted on yesterday is trying to address that issue to ensure that the European Union external borders, because most people that are coming to Ireland applying for asylum are coming from some other European country first. So they're entering the European Union and then they're moving around trying to apply for asylum, claiming that they're refugees from a war-torn area. So we need to get a handle on this across the entirety of the European Union. No one country can deal with it.
So can you explain then in layman terms, for instance, somebody who knows nothing about this vote that's been passed, this pact, what it means? Is it securing the border around the EU?
Yes, it is. It's about securing the border around the EU. So, I mean, if a person comes into the European Union, so they arrive on European land somewhere, we'll just say Greece, for example, which is a place where a lot of them will come from. If they come there and they apply for asylum and they have a documentation, well, then they will remain there and they will be assessed there over a period of time. If they come in there and they don't have any documentation, or if they come from a third country where they have no entitlement to come from because it's not an unsafe country or there's no war or they're not fleeing persecution, there's going to be a fast-track system in place whereby those people will be assessed very quickly and a decision made as to whether they can remain or they will be returned. There'll also be, you know, a full database of people when they come into the country from third countries where there will be facial recognition, fingerprinting, to ensure that we know where people are and how many are there at the time and that there isn't multiple applications from the same individual for asylum across the European Union. That is one of the significant challenges, Neil, is they may apply for asylum in Germany or France or elsewhere, and then they may also come to Ireland and apply for asylum as well. So it is to deal with these particular issues so that we get a measure on it. Look, we're all conscious of the fact that there's huge pressures on, and you can see that the rise of the right and the far right are on this particular issue. But we also have obligations as well, and we must try and deal with this
issue,
in a way
that's I have an issue with this term far right all of the time. I understand that the moniker of far right has been branded on people who engaged in the rioting in Dublin and what have you, and other protests that got out of hand. But you know, even somebody who says enough is enough and it's our duty to protect our borders, it's our duty to control migration, they're being called far right, but they're not far right at all.
No, Neil, there's a fundamental difference between a person saying that you can protect your borders. I'm saying that we should protect our borders. But I mean, when we talk about the far right, I'm talking about the extreme elements across Europe that are violent, that use violence. There's a big difference between raising an issue, speaking about an issue, and people who engage in very violent behavior.
I'm not disagreeing with you. I just said that. I'm saying, but people are being called far right now. It's being thrown at people who are saying, we need to protect our borders, we need to control migration, we can't let this to continue. And they're being called far right.
But then I'm far right, so is it? Because I voted yesterday in the European Parliament to ensure that we had a migration and asylum pact in place that would protect our borders, that would ensure that the flow of people was dealt with in an orderly manner. I'm supporting ensuring that we have proper border controls. I'm not far right. I'm centrist. But the point being made is when we say far right, it can be sometimes a throwaway remark, but across Europe, they are far right elements that are very violent and agitated to the point where they want, you know, to people to attack migrants, to attack minorities. So that is the issue I'm referring to. But a person raising an issue with legitimate concerns about, yes, there's pressures on the school or pressures on a hospital or pressures on housing, they're legitimate concerns. It's up to politicians to deal with this in a calm, rational, intelligent manner, and I believe this particular pact that we voted on yesterday will address the issue as best it can in terms of ensuring we have proper border controls, that when people come in, there's timely manners. One of the biggest problems we have, Neil, is there's no integrity in the system, in the sense that when people come in, they make applications, it goes on forever and a day until a decision is made out of whether they remain or not, and if they're not to remain, they're still not removed, and that is a significant issue, because if you don't have a sanction at the end of the day in terms of return from where you came from, well then, you know, it has this pull effect.
That's an interesting point. Let's say somebody goes through the process and is found not to have been meeting the criteria for remain. They have to self-deport themselves from Ireland. That seems kind of very lax, doesn't it? How do we know if somebody who's been refused, for instance, they could be refused because they've criminal past, very serious criminal past, for instance, but yet they're allowed to stay in the country until they themselves decide to self-deport themselves.
Yes, and that's what was one of the weaknesses, not just in Ireland, but across many countries. And bearing in mind, there's been different systems in different countries, and that's one of the difficulties we had. We had no uniformity across Europe. Now, this particular pact is trying to encourage countries to bring in regulations and legislation to ensure that it's uniformity. So if a person doesn't meet the conditions when they come into the European Union, well, then they will actually be assessed, but they will also be detained for a period of time. So if they have no documentation, if they, you know, if they could, if there's a suspicion that they may be involved in criminality, if there's concern, should we say, well, then there's an ability to detain them for a period of time, do an assessment, and then the ability to return them to where they came from. So these particular issues, you know, are being put in place. Obviously, it's up to member states like Ireland to ensure that they resource, you know, the Gardaí, the immigration offices right across the entirety to ensure that there's integrity. Firstly, you can assess people quickly, and also in the event of their people not qualifying, that they are returned.
Okay, so that wouldn't really impact on Ireland, because we're the last port of call, really. We're furthest away west. People don't really land in Ireland first. They would be more likely to land in Eastern Europe, wouldn't they? Perhaps Italy or Greece or Germany, forgive me, or places like that. So we really wouldn't have that pressure of admin, would we?
Well, I mean, there's always going to be a flow of people, and they primarily come via Spain, Italy, and Greece, and you know elsewhere across the Eastern European borders. But the Eastern European borders are fairly well protected because of the fact that you have Russia on the other side of many of them, and there's obviously the fear that there could actually be an invasion. So they have quite well protected there. But along Greece, Italy, and Spain, you know, you have migrants risking life and limb, and the tragedies we see unfolding in the Mediterranean on a regular basis. But once they come into the European Union, there's now mechanisms in place where they will be dealt with quickly in terms of making an assessment. And the problem here for a long period of time is Greece was unable to deal with it on its own. Italy was the same, and Spain, they were under so much pressure and you know, completely overwhelmed. So they would then move from there up across the European Union itself, and eventually would get to places like Ireland and elsewhere. So that's what's happening. So the idea that we would have a proper external border control benefits us all in terms of the Ireland itself within the European Union as well.
Okay. Are there quotas as well, did I hear, where you could be fined for not accepting your quota of those that are seeking to come here?
Well, there's what's called a solidarity fund. So effectively, they estimate that about 30,000 asylum people, claimants, you know, for asylum migrants that come into the European Union. They're going to look at it from the point of view that they can't all be in Greece or Spain or Italy. So there's a mechanism now being put in place whereby they will do an assessment based on population of a country, the GDP, and a few more criteria. And, you know, you will be asked to take X number based on your population or whether or not, if you're already under pressure, well, then you can make a financial contribution, and that particular applicant can be located elsewhere. So if they were in Greece, Greece is under pressure. We say we're not taking any more because we're under pressure ourselves. Well, then we make a contribution, and they could be.
That's a fine, isn't it?
Well, it's not a fine.
I heard it was like €30,000 per refused.
20,000
euro, forgive me, yeah, per refused asylum seeker. So that is a fine, isn't it?
Well, you can also take them. But I mean, like, it could cost you more than 20,000.
No, but you're saying you could put your hand up and say, no, sorry, we're full, somebody else will have to do this one. But that isn't the case. You have to pay a fine when you say, sorry, we can't take any more.
Well, that could happen as well. But equally, and on top of that, you could also give assistance to other countries, not a fine. You could provide administrative support. You could make other contributions as well. The idea is, rather than having them all in one place where there's no capabilities to assess them, make sure that they're dealt with in an efficient manner. So you have the Greek islands, you have Lampedusa in the Mediterranean, you have southern Spain. So the idea is that in the event of those countries being overwhelmed, an assessment is made, and the European Union will say, well, look, will you take X number? If you have the ability to take them, some countries will take them. And if you don't, want to or you can't, well, then you make a contribution, either in monetary terms or providing other assistance.
And will this system be able to differentiate between an economic asylum seeker, as in this would be like, you know, asylum tourism, if you like, trying to come to a country because they have a better life, as opposed to somebody who's fleeing war or persecution?
Yes, I mean, there's two things here. I mean, the first thing is people applying for asylum. So asylum is a specific area that you apply for, and that's based on fleeing persecution, a threat to life, you know, coming from a minority area where you're oppressed.
Yeah.
Then the issue of migration. Migration is another issue, and that has been dealt with because we do need to see an increased talent pool in Europe. The population is struggling. We've labour shortages right.
Yeah, but that could be done with work visas now and through proper channels.
Yes, but
looked up to JFK now and said that they wouldn't be taking, they wouldn't give you the time of day.
Yes, that's the point I'm making. So there is there's a proposal as well at EU to establish what's called a talent pool. So effectively, rather than people trying to get in illegally for employment purposes, that they would actually make a formal application. And bear in mind, you take, for example, Georgia. I mean, Georgia is a country that's actually an applicant country to join the European Union. So it is not deemed to be an unsafe country. Because if it was an unsafe country, it couldn't make an application to join the European Union.
Yeah.
Yet we were facilitating in terms of people making an application for asylum coming from Georgia. Now, most of those people that were coming there were making an application, but by and large, they were coming for work reasons. And, you know, I think it would be a lot more logical if we actually had a proper work visa system in place that it did an assessment of the entirety of the labour market in the European Union so people could have legal pathways to come here rather than coming in, making an application for asylum, knowing full well that it's not the right way to go, but that's the way they want, the only way they can get in there.
Okay. So this is the best deal possible. And it will come into effect when?
Well, I mean, the legislation is passed. Now it's up to individual member states to ensure that they put forward. They might have to pass legislation themselves, put systems in place, and put regulations in place. And bear in mind, Neil, look, just finally on this particular issue. I mean, when we had 1 million Syrians that arrived in Greece in 2015, and they walked up through the Balkans, there were some European countries like put up barbed wire fences on their southern borders. Hungary, Austria, and others. They actually closed their borders within the European Union and forced them to go around. They all eventually ended up in Germany, where they, you know, 1 million of them are now.
Who did that? What countries was that?
Hungary, Austria. Certainly, that is anywhere they actually erected.
So they're the countries that I'm pulling their weight.
Well, certainly in the time of 2015, when you had 1 million Syrians coming.
But have they improved those countries? I'm just wondering, are they now pulling their weight?
Well, time will tell now. I mean, they've allowed this particular migration and asylum pact to be passed. You know, they didn't veto it. So it is now up to member states to...
Okay.
What
happens when all member states, just finally, what happens when all member states ultimately become overwhelmed?
Well, I mean, all member states may not be overwhelmed because, I mean, if this system works, well, then there is a system that controls our borders. But bear in mind, Germany, for example, is under huge pressure in terms of the labour market. Italy is under significant pressure. Population drops across Europe. So our population, Ireland is one of the few countries where we have, you know, an increasing population. So there's a significant issue around the need to ensure that we have proper flows.
But you know, nobody would have a problem with that with labour. I mean, you want to have your head tested if you had a problem with people wanting to come here legitimately to work. It's the characters that destroy their documents. That's one of the big problems. And certainly in the what I watched last night in Ballinrobe or Ross Gray or Galway or Killarney, the IPOs that are coming in here,
yes, and that's why this particular
people are wary of them.
Specifically mentions that issue of, you know, coming in illegally, not cooperating, not having documentation. There's actually a fast track system in place specifically in this particular proposal. And also last week there was a court case in Dublin where a person arrived into Dublin Airport without documentation and they subsequently were jailed. Now, I'm not saying that, you know, but you have people, smugglers, they're giving documentation to people, facilitating them to get on planes, and then they're actually taking the documentation off them before they go to the immigration office. But, I mean, we have to ensure there's integrity in the system, and if you want integrity, well, then you have to enforce it.
Okay.
And that means, from time to time, people being returned.
Okay, thank you, Billy. Much obliged to you, as always, for unravelling that one. Billy Keller, MEP, Ireland South. Back after the break, Paul Trevaux down in Killarney next. Text 0868 104 106.
Text or WhatsApp Neil now. 0868 104 106.
The Neil Prendeville Show on Red FM.
Meanwhile, those who volunteer in Dublin say they have run out of tents for homeless asylum seekers in Dublin alone. I watched that show last night called Is Ireland Full on Virgin. Perhaps you saw it yourself, your thoughts on it. A welcome text 0868 104 106. And one of those that featured in it, and it looked quite an amount of detail, say for instance at Killarney, and one of those that featured was the chef patron of Trevaux's restaurant in Killarney, Paul Trevaux, and he joins me by WhatsApp. Paul, good morning.
Neil, how are you, sir?
I'm good, my man. I got to tell you, in spite of your concerns and footfall drops and everything, the ex-Taoiseach really recently said nobody has a veto on who lives in their community. And that includes you. It's really, according to Leo Varadkar, none of your business.
I actually made a point. Well, first of all, I can give you 10 more minutes of waffle like your last contributor, or else I can tell you a bit of the
truth.
Oh,
my God, please don't tell me it was waffle. I'd hate to waste your time
on waffle. When you start hearing things like this now, you will. So listen to what our previous Taoiseach said, that people who have lived for decades upon decades and generations upon generations in small towns and villages throughout rural Ireland do not have a veto as to who moves into their community, but he does. So that sounds like a dictatorship to me. Mm. So people who have spent a lifetime and families and generations of building up wonderful towns, amazing towns and villages throughout the country cannot say, listen, those 500 people who are coming into that hotel, we'd prefer, you know, maybe 200 and spread it out a little bit. No, no, no. You're taking all 500. So people don't have the veto, but the politicians do.
Okay.
We're about to spend 4 billion, with a B, 4 billion euro on immigration throughout this country in 2024 alone. 60% of that, and that's been admitted by Roger O'Gorman and his Department of Integration, 60% of that are wrongful immigrants, illegal immigrants coming into the country that we are doing nothing about. So that is 2.4 billion money. And I heard you earlier on just after nine saying about conditions of roads and conditions of services, and we don't have the money and we don't have that. That alone, that 2.4 billion saving, if we were to remove all those people, would build a state-of-the-art 2 or 3 prisons, hospitals with accommodation beside it so that we could actually welcome in immigrants that are coming here to work and contribute to society.
Or fleeing persecution, or fleeing war.
No, listen, let's talk about reality, right? So your last contributor turned around and said, somebody who's coming in that doesn't have any documentation. Well, we're working on a plan on how to do that now with this new deal that we're coming up with the EU. I have a plan today. Here's what we're going to do. And how are you doing, buddy? You don't have your passport? No. Well, it shows up here on my records that you showed your passport back in London where you've been living for the last 3 years where you flew in from. So would you do us a favor? Hop on that plane over there and go over to Heathrow and have a little look around on the ground to see where you dropped it. So stop taking the proverbial out of us by saying you don't have documentation, yet you had it when you showed it. Oh, but that's racist, that's mean, that's bold, that's bad. Well, when are we going to stand up for our own country? And it's very, very important. This is one point I said that didn't make into the edit. Don't you dare label us as racist, because for decades upon decades, we have welcomed so many people from so many nations, from Poland, Lithuania, Latvia, Croatia, African nations all around the world that have been welcomed into this country as if when we travel abroad to go work somewhere else, that work and contribute to society.
Yeah.
Those are the immigrants that we are delighted to help. We are also delighted to help those who are fleeing war and persecution. But unfortunately, most of those who need the help are still stuck in Ukraine because they didn't have the means to get out the way the ones that have come here have.
Okay.
We've just spent 12 million on pets from Ukraine. That would have built 24 state-of-the-art AstroTurf pitches around the country that all the kids, whether they be Irish or foreign, could play on. But we've spent 12 million on housing Ukrainian pets.
That's totally taking the mic.
At what stage is a journalist going to bring in Roger O'Gorman and nail him on primetime, nail him on your show, nail him on Today FM, or nail him on any radio station and turn around and say, Roger, I have a simple question for you. We've got the D Hotel in Drogheda that turned over a million profit when it was trading as a hotel. You and your department have just awarded a Chinese consortium who coincidentally bought that hotel 6 months before it was awarded a contract to house immigrants. You've just awarded them a 13 million euro a year deal. Would you not have offered them 2 and said, lads, you're still making cash? There's a hotel in Killarney that's making 650,000 euro a month bottom line profit. They wouldn't make that in a year trading as a hotel. Are you sure you're offering the right rate, Roderick? Because me, you, and everybody listening here today is paying for this. Do you guys have you any idea how to negotiate deals?
But you can't blame a hotel for taking that check. I mean, they've got 100% occupancy. Yeah.
Yeah, if I had a 200-bedroom hotel, business-wise, I would take them in myself. I don't need to staff them. I don't need to rate it. I don't need to insure it. I don't, and I even get a refurb grant when it's all done and dusted. There's not a person on the planet with a business mind that would turn that down. That's not my point. My point is that we are offering absolute insane rates, 24 hours, 7 days a week, 100% occupancy, that hotels that would hit probably a 60-65% per annum.
But Paul, you do know, because you stay up to date on this, that the government now is not renewing and beginning to move away from renewing any upcoming deal they have with many hotels. They're not renewing the deals.
Forgive my cynicism, but I don't believe a goddamn word that comes out of the government's mouth, because they're adding in new hotels. Every month we're seeing a new hotel being awarded a contract. And what's incredible here is that the government, 18 months ago, 2 years ago, Sinn Féin in particular, were labeling the likes of myself and other people that just went, hang on a second here, guys. Nobody has an issue with anybody coming into a country. The Irish people will give you the shirt off your back if we think you need it more than me. But you've got 13 shirts on already. Are you sure you need mine? When we called out that the population of Killarney increased by 13% in 3 months, I said, hang on a second, lads. There's going to be a knock-on effect. Just a simple question to the Department of Integration, and particularly to you, Roderick. Has anyone in your department done a feasibility study into Killarney? And I always use Killarney as an example because that's where I'm based. But this is happening in Westport, Youghal, Donegal, the length and breadth of the country.
Okay.
Has anyone in your department done a feasibility study on how many people we can put into a town or a village in rural Ireland without drastically affecting the dynamics of that town?
Okay, so they say,
and the answer is no.
So 40% of tourist beds are gone in Killarney, right? So that's having a knock-on impact on pubs or restaurants or the service industries regarding tourism. Has it hurt you?
100%. I said last night in the documentary on Virgin, and I have to admit, fair play to Virgin for airing it, because I thought that I could have been stitched up, or Manny's could have been stitched up to say, look at all these racist lads saying we don't want anybody. But they actually nailed the government. Brilliant. About time somebody in the media nailed the government on it. So what we simply have is that, so the hotels and the accommodation providers, who again, I do not blame on a business point of view for taking them in, because there's great money to be made in it. We have them 40% full. We have the 60% that don't have them, and they're doing great because they can now double their rates because of the basis of simple economics of supply and demand. So they don't want the likes of me on the radio talking about this, because no matter what they try and do, they can't ruin Killarney. Killarney is one of the most stunning places on earth. However, there's 40% less people on the street, and that's the issue. So the bar, the restaurant, the Jarvie, the sweet shop, the knick-knack shop, all that stuff, but it's bigger than that, Neil. This is where people need to understand this. It's the knock-on and the indirect services affected with tourism that are suffering too. So if I have a bad year, I'm not calling in my painter and decorator to do the whole place up. I'm not calling the taxi drivers often because I'm down my 30, 40%. Mm. Now, we're very lucky because, contrary to what the trolls and bots and certain politicians have tried to label me as, anybody with a brain knows that what I've said has been true. How do I know that? We're now changing legislation at an EU level to agree with everything I said 12, 18 months ago. We now have a government that are turning around and saying, Jesus, lads, you know what? We might actually have an issue here with immigration. Maybe we didn't do it right. But I said this to you 12, 18 months ago, guys. I wasn't the only one. And they labelled us everything. And everybody was afraid to say anything. Nobody would bring Trevo onto the radio because he was going to rattle cages and state the bloody obvious. Where have you come from? Where's your passport? Where's your documentation? Don't have it. But you had it on the plane to get here. So you must have shown it.
But
so here's what we're going to do, because you know what happened, Neil, with all due respect. Sorry for I'm ranting because I can tell my frustration. And this is the sentiment of the people in the country right now. Do you know what happened? Because as soon as that lad got in, he sent a text or a phone call to his mates and went, come on into Ireland. It's the softest touch. But are you not getting deported? Yeah. I mean, guess what they said? Make your own way to the airport. Not even that. Book your own flight, pal. That's the country we're coming into.
But okay. Well, that probably is a good summation. But at this level now, with the change in law, it'll be even harder to get into the EU at all. It tightens the European Union border. So that's got to be a step in the right direction. So it's the point of entry now that the character without the documentation gets refused.
Do you know what is the most important thing to start? Never mind Mickey Mouse legislation that's still not 100% passed through the EU into all the separate members of the country. Is get out who's in this country right now. Get out. So in the 80s, just to put this into context, in the 80s when America and Cuba kissed and made up, do you know what Castro did? Empty the prisons and the asylum centers. And he said, get on the boats, get on the planes, head up there to America and do whatever you want to do up there. And if I see you back here, I'm going to put a bullet in your head.
Mm.
In context with the EU, we've had over 20 countries that could do the same and say, off you go to that country and in you go. And you can say whatever you want, but they get fingerprinted and they get checked. You ask the Gardaí in this country, who are doing a phenomenal job of dealing. They have no idea where these people are. They have no idea who they are. There are hotels around this country that have a Garda car outside of 24/7, making sure that the absolute muck doesn't hit the fan. And we and these brilliant people who are defending our nation can't say anything for obvious reasons. But this is what's going on. And we can keep our head in the sand and we can keep our heads buried forever, amen, or we can finally cop on, be honest, and challenge this government and bring Roderick O'Gorman to task and turn around and say, you have made a monumental mess of immigration in this country and every single person in the country is paying for it.
Okay, thank you, Paul. As always, Paul Trevoux in Killarney. Pick up on the conversation. Text 0868 104 106. Back after 10.
Show on Red FM. Conversation that matters.
Get involved. Text 0868 104 106. Lots of texts already this morning. I've posted some photographs yesterday of a serious risk taker. We're saying online it's taking the term planking to an entirely new level. These were pretty frightening photographs of a car carrying very, very long wooden planks dangerously hanging out of the car window, the front left, and out through the back of the boot. I mean, like very, I mean, there must have been 6 or 7 feet of plank out the window and the back. Got a big response to that with regards to the crazy thing you see with people driving cars. Kathleen says it would just take one silly mistake on someone's part and you could have a very serious accident, especially taking into consideration the way people drive, weather conditions. People just need to cop themselves on. Others didn't disagree with the pictures we shared. David says, leave that person, go to work. Nothing about who's taken the picture, I suppose. Down here in West Cork, that's a regular occurrence, says Tara. Oanya says, I'm so happy in the days of no social media. I packed a Christmas tree full into the car, boot open. I had to drive with one hand on the tree about 13 years ago. Daniel says, all I see in your photographs is someone getting the job done. Rob says, honestly, this does just show that we have sort of gotten too soft. Years ago, people would not chance this type of nonsense because they'd run into the guards or someone would call the guards, but the chances of being stopped by a guard now are slim to nothing. So that's a selection of texts on that. I travel to Cork every morning and evening. I notice cars going faster and faster, flashing their lights to pass you out. No wonder there are accidents on our roads. Unfortunately, there'll be more. And one more on that. We have a maximum speed limit in this country, and then we are allowed to buy cars that can do twice the speed limit. How does that make sense? We'll be given something that can actually break the law. Well, I suppose you could probably blame the German Autobahn for that. All of the cars are built with that in mind, I guess, when there is no speed limit upon it. Putting an injection centre, as you mentioned earlier, in the city centre is complete madness. People legally high in the city, there'll be chaos. It'll be ludicrous. Put it outside in the country somewhere. Who's thinking this is a good idea? Put it in a TD's area or a ministerial area and see how they would like it. And then the Ukrainian pets that are costing us over €1 million a month. Who do our public representatives actually represent? Our establishment seems to hate us. Are they taking the pee with €1 million a month on Ukrainian cats and dogs? Billy Kelleher, if everyone who asks questions about refugees is far right, then Fine Gael, Fianna Fáil, Sinn Féin and all political parties must be worried because it would make the far right the largest party in Ireland, says Pat. People also need to be aware, Neil, that if we don't engage with the pact in the EU, every person that we don't take will cost us €20,000. Wasn't it the far left that ruined the country? Says somebody else. One way to control illegal immigration is to fine the transport companies, the airlines and the ferries. This EU migration pact has been steamrolled through the door without discussion, just like the referendum on durable relationships. There's many on this. All the boats going to the UK and all the single men going to Northern Ireland and down into Dublin. That's what's happening. The UK is not in the EU. We will also have to take loads from Greece and Italy. It's a big selection of them, which I'll come back to throughout the course of the morning. I got calls on the way, but I just want to read this for you. It's one of the more extraordinary emails that I've received in quite a long time, and I get some extraordinary emails. Morning, Neil. I would love to share a story with you guys. This is dated April 10th, so I only got it yesterday. Last Tuesday, my partner and I, women in their early 40s, both of us, made our way to Dublin to support the girls in green at the Aviva Stadium. I was so excited because it was my second football match ever to attend, since my first back in Germany in my early 20s. It was my partner's first match ever. We got to the Viva, we bought 4 pints of Carlsberg so we wouldn't have to leave our seats during the match. As we were just about to enter, we were told that alcohol was not allowed into the stadium. That really wasn't a big issue for us 80s ladies, so we drank one each and left 2 behind so we could see the game from the get-go. Armoured with Irish flags from head to toe, Irish colours and whistles, we enjoyed the first half immensely, cheering the girls on, come on Ireland, blowing our whistles and just enjoying ourselves. At halftime, we needed the loo, and I was approached on the way by a steward who told me that there was a complaint made by a man who said his daughters were scared. Irish fans scared of us cheering, chanting and shouting on our girls to make us proud. The steward smiled at me and was as surprised as I, because a full stadium can usually be very loud. I couldn't for the life of me understand how 2 13-year-old Irish supporters were intimidated by us or anyone else cheering and chanting for our team with the loud English supporters that were right next to us. I told the steward, though, that I would keep it down. Now, imagine you're at a big game and you have to keep the noise down because the snowflake generation felt intimidated, which I do not understand for the life of me. No profanities were hurled, just come on Ireland. As the second half of the match kicked off, I was obviously chanting as a very passionate supporter of the women's Irish soccer team. Sure, I wasn't the parent of the kids, sure I wasn't, and I was there for my own pleasure and entertainment. The father of the girls must have complained me again. And we were approached by the Gardaí, who then escorted us out of the stadium. We were escorted out of the stadium. The issue I have is the snowflake generation. If I had 2 scared 13-year-old girls, I would have taken them home instead of ruining someone else's night. Or I would have told them just to cop themselves on. If chanting and being loud is scary to kids, then perhaps there should be something in place that you need to be at least 16 to enter a game. I'm sick and tired of the snowflake generation. It's triggered and offended and upset by what I class as normal. Nowadays, you can't even crack a joke without some snowflakes starting a discussion because they're so bleeding in the need of a backbone or balls and in desperate need of a sense of humour. I was just wondering if any other folks had the same experience as myself, or folks that also think that parents need to toughen up on their offspring. Don't give up my personal details. I won't. But it's an extraordinary email. Now, I suppose you'd have to be there, really, to witness how loud it was or how, you know, I mean, 13-year-olds should expect quite a amount of chanting and, cheering or, you know, come on Ireland or blowing whistles and stuff like that. I mean, it is an international soccer match all the same. But what do you think of that? I mean, I thought it was totally over the top that they would ultimately be escorted by 2 Gardaí, not out of their seats or where they were standing, not out of the state, you know, not into the foyer or into the bar, but actually out of the stadium. Isn't that a bit over the top when you think of it in the world we live in now? Is it just got too snowflakey? You know, do young people nowadays just get stressed and anxious and frightened about the simplest of things that they shouldn't? And if so, why? Why have they got that way? What's done it to them? Anyway, pick up the phone, 0818 104 106. Text 0868 104 106.
Call Neil now, 0818
104 106. The Neil Prendeville Show on Red FM.
That's it. Get involved in the conversation. The Neil Prendeville Show with Mercedes-Benz Cork. Text 0868 104 106. Come back to lots of other texts throughout the course of the morning. But it's an important day today. It's World Parkinson's Day today. I was reading up on Parkinson's yesterday. It's only second to Alzheimer's now in this country as our most common degenerative disorder. I mean, we know, like, internationally of very famous people who have become very strong ambassadors and advocates because they also lived, or indeed some of them have passed away now, but had Alzheimer's, pardon me, Parkinson's. Amongst them was Muhammad Ali and Michael J. Fox, Neil Diamond, Billy Connolly. Interestingly, I wasn't aware, but Pope John Paul II, Ozzy Osbourne, obviously, Alan Alda, who's a very famous actor, starting his work in MASH all those years ago, but many people. Some people use the term suffering with Parkinson's. I wonder, is it a fair one, or do you live with Parkinson's or deal with it as best you can? Tony Wilkinson was diagnosed in London in 2015. He joins me by phone. Tony, good morning.
Good morning, Neil.
I know that you subsequently moved to Ireland and I believe to West Cork. Is that correct?
That's right, yes. Yeah. I was diagnosed over in the UK in 2015.
And why did you go and get a diagnosis? I mean, what were the early signs?
Well, I actually had a previous operation on my neck, and that was getting along happily, but the things started happening. I was dropping things, tripping over, falling, and a few other things, and the consultant wasn't happy and sent me along to visit a different consultant.
Did you have a shake?
Not really at the time. Nothing noticeable. I mean, everyone thinks that's the first sign, but it's not always the first sign of Parkinson to shake. You know,
brushing off things, dropping things.
There are 40 different symptoms, really.
Wow.
Think about it. Okay. You know.
So you did go for a second consultancy, and was it at that stage then that news was broken to you?
Yes. Well, what happened was I went along, and I walked down the corridor, and the consultant sort of saw me and said, could you walk back up the corridor and then come back down again? I thought, fine. Then he asked me to open and shut his office door a few times. So I could tell him quite clearly that his hinges were well oiled. They weren't squeaking. And that was part of my diagnosis. No. And then he got me to do a few finger exercises, Neil, and things like this. And then he went along, he said, come and sit in this chair, and across a great big desk, he then said, you have Parkinson's. That was it. It was white noise after that. He was chatting away, but I heard nothing.
Really?
Yeah. It came as a shock, and I was by myself, and all I can remember then was him standing up, putting his hand out. I shook it and walked out the door.
There wasn't a lot said then, having just told you, Mr. Wilkinson, you have Parkinson's.
Oh my goodness, he was talking away.
Okay.
But, it just went right over my head. The white noise, the shock, really, of that. I mean, I must have sat there for about a good 5 odd minutes, 10 minutes, but I didn't pick anything up.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God.
You know, it was that much of a hit to me.
And what would have been your understanding or knowledge of Parkinson's then, on that day and the hours and days that passed? I mean, this was 2015, so what had you known about Parkinson's?
Well, previously, it was not on my radar. I knew of it as a disease, and I knew people who had Parkinson's, but not too well. So I knew there was a disease, and like everyone else, oh, the person has a tremor, and they walk and shuffle along. Their walk changes, their gait. And that's really all I knew. And
First thing you did was ring your wife.
Oh my goodness, yeah. You know, I came out of the building at Queen Square. I got on the phone and my wife was at work, and I was just ranting, saying, you're not going to believe what this person said, because I was just in denial straight away.
Really?
But she was at work. She did, as anyone would do, she just Googled Parkinson's, got the list of symptoms, and she then looked down and she was going, no, no, yes, no, yes, yes, no, to the symptoms. And she acknowledged and knew I had Parkinson's before I accepted it. you know, that's the way it was.
Yeah. You probably also knew that it was incurable.
Yes. And you mentioned at the beginning of this about there being a load of world-famous advocates.
Mm.
So I'm not world-famous, but I'm a ferocious advocate now for Parkinson's. So I have looked into it in great detail, and I have been to the Doyle many times speaking on behalf of people with Parkinson's, putting the case forward for better services and everything.
Good man. In the 9 years since, though, have you developed more symptoms and more complications as a result?
Well, yes. What happens is, as you said, there is no cure, but it progresses. It progresses. And what happens is there are means and ways of slowing the progression. We are constantly told exercise, exercise. And that is hugely important. It really is. The point about it being that you exercise your mind, keep your brain active. That is important.
Mm.
Physically keep yourself active. And there are various types of exercises that are around. PD Warriors, SMOVIES, which I use and you know about.
What are they?
SMOVIES are, they are, the best way of describing them is like holding two capital D's in your hands on the straight bit. And they're plastic ribbed, and inside are four ball bearings, and they move and they make a noise when you do it. Now, I did the Cork half marathon a couple of years ago, and the only way I could get around was by using these SMOVIES. And I'd done so much exercise, I have trouble walking a straight line, but with the SMOVIES, I ended up, I could run.
So you ran the half marathon in under 3 hours. Now, you did train hard for it.
I did. I was up in the morning, and I was spotted all around Bandon, and I was becoming quite a feature, because as cars were passing me and trucks were passing me, they were flashing their lights, tooting their horns, because I was out early, early in the morning doing all of those exercises, and it was really, really important. And the other thing that is very, very important exercise wise is set dancing.
Good man.
Irish set dancing is incredibly good for people with Parkinson's.
These activities that you do, does that slow down the progression ultimately?
It helps. You see, the progression is different for everybody. The progression for some people can be a very, very slow incline. One of the things that is happening at the moment is there is a greater amount of people who are getting early onset Parkinson's.
That's younger, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah.
That's right. That's below the age of 50, that type of age. You know, there are people in their 30s who get Parkinson's.
And why this is a brain condition, isn't it?
That's right.
It's not genetic, it's not hereditary, it's just bad luck.
Well, they are looking into the genetic side of it. I was told when I first got it that it was 1 in 500, and it was basically flick a coin in the air, and then the last person to get heads all the way, you got Parkinson's. That's how I was told. Very blunt, but that was the way they described it. But all of these things, exercising the mind, the brain, these help help you slow down the progression. It's all slow little bits. It's important, very important to do this.
So you really have to work on it. You really have to fight it and attack it and fight back. Because also, I did hear that men more than women are diagnosed with Parkinson's. Is there?
That's right.
Is there any research into why it could be affecting more men?
Well, we're not sure on that, but one of the big research projects, and again, I need to give a shout out, Neil, to the wonderful work being done at UCC by the Parkinson's Disease Research Cluster. Now, they did the first national mapping project of Parkinson's, but one of the other major projects they did was the Parkinson's and pesticides. There has been a huge link with Parkinson's and pesticides, and we did research from UCC regarding that.
Okay, okay. As in the use or the proximity around pesticides, is it?
Yes, it's incredible. And now, when I first came over to Ireland and I became a member of the local group, I came back and said to Kate, I cannot, I'm absolutely flabbergasted the amount of farmers that have Parkinson's.
Really?
She said, this is Cork, the old farming thing. But as time came on and everything, and I became chair of the local group at the time, I was struck. And I knew that within 17 kilometres of Bandon, where I live, there were four father sons in farming with Parkinson's.
And that link now, has been categorically made. But you it wasn't the reason for you coming down with it, was it? You weren't working in...
No. There are other reasons as well, you know, but pesticides, the link is there. And the in America, they've started paying out now, big time, to farmers.
Pesticide companies?
The agri-chemical companies that are making the stuff, yes.
But is there any breakthrough research going on that will, as they're saying, is there any trials going on or testing going on at the moment that ultimately will see this thing as a disease of the past?
Well, there are various huge amounts of work going on with different aspects, whether it be with stem cells, stuff like this. One of the major research, again, back at UCC, and I have to credit Professor John Cryan, who is looking at the microbiome, that is the gut. And there is a huge link, Neil, with the gut and the brain via the vagus canal. So it goes up along the spine into the brain. And it's the gut that actually feeds and helps the brain with nutrition. And by keeping a healthy gut, it actually encourages the area where the dopamine, which is the main cause
of... But again, is that just is that just slowing down something you already have?
It's part of people wanting to find a cure. I mean,
or is it what you're talking about? Is it preventing somebody that they will never come down with Parkinson's or come down with dementia or Alzheimer's and things like that?
I could not say that.
Yeah.
Again, one of the frustrations is that it's 200 odd years now that we've known of Parkinson's and there is no cure. Yet, my goodness, the incredible amount of work when you found out about COVID. So, you know, this is something that we need to look at, because the amount of people in Ireland that will have Parkinson's in the next decade is going to double.
Do we have a figure?
So, well, let's say there's 18,000 at the moment in Ireland. Just say it's approximately that. That is going to double in the next decade. So that is...
That's again, alarming.
A huge burden.
That's alarming.
That's frightening. Yeah. And that's a huge burden. So if we haven't got the ability to look after people with Parkinson's now and give them the correct treatments...
That's extraordinary, because it's not an old person's disease, right? Firstly.
Oh, that's right.
The population is not going to double in the next decade. So that doesn't make sense as to why would Parkinson's double in 10 years? What is the underlying reason for it?
Well, it is demographic, the fact that we are aging as a population. And it does mainly come up at the top end of that aging demographic. But there is a growth now with the younger people getting Parkinson's.
And do you worry about the future? Do you worry about your condition deteriorating?
I would be a liar if I said I didn't. I battle. I live with Parkinson's. My Parkinson's hates me. That's the way I put it. It absolutely hates me because I do not give it the opportunity to get the better of me. There are days it'll win and I can't get out of bed. And I'll go, okay, you've won that battle. But the bigger war, that's for me. Okay. And I fight that every day.
And 8 years on, 9 years on, actually, forgive me. Has anybody within medical circles said to you something along the lines of that you are incredible in the sense that 8 years on, your condition should be much worse than it actually is?
You see, again, that's a difficult thing to pin down, Neil, because everybody declines at a different rate. Everybody can tread water as such for a certain length of time.
Right.
Because we could be stronger. There is an awful lot of personal aspect into it. I could sit down in a chair and go, woe is me. But I am, or I can stand up and I can say to Parkinson, get lost. I've had enough of you. Yeah. And, you know, again, there is an attitude to it as to keeping it where I am.
But is the one dominant thing in your life? I mean, do you enjoy all of the other aspects of your life as best you can as you continue with this 24/7 battle?
Oh, I will do what I can. I go set dancing at Ballinhassick on a Tuesday, which is brilliant. There's a lovely group of people there doing that. And that's important to me because there's a community feeling there. And there's a wonderful little group of people who don't have Parkinson's, but they come along and help us. They partner us in that. So
okay.
That's great. And I will do anything to keep myself on the right side of healthy. And yes, there are days. I was in hospital, CUH, a little while back, and there are days when I'm not good. I have to get my wife to help me dress. I'm not embarrassed in saying that.
So these are issues involving what we normally we would regard as being automatic movements. You can have days where you can't. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, I could have woken up this morning and when Shane spoke to me, I could have said there's no chance of me doing the interview. You know, that's the way it is.
Is it that there would be days when your speech might change or, you know, is it your writing mightn't be legible or you might have tremors?
Well, as some people say, Tony, you must be a qualified doctor. Because your handwriting is illegible.
You and me both.
But it is, you know, and I actually look at it and I have very good friends that keep me down, my feet on the ground. I have huge support. And I have to say, since moving to Bandon, I found the people here have been incredibly, incredibly understanding.
You're very positive,
man. All over the place.
Yeah. Hmm? You're a very positive man in spite of it.
As I said, I could sit in a chair and moan about the world, but I don't want to. I want to get up. I still want to do things. You know, In fact, I've actually struck more things off the bucket list since getting Parkinson's.
Like what?
Before. Well, for our 60th, we went up into the Arctic Circle on a cruise. It was fantastic. And this was in early January. Now, if I told you that at the beginning of December I'd had a stroke, then, you know, that's how determined I am.
Wow.
So, yes, and advocating for people with Parkinson's has become quite a life thing for me. I will fight for everybody. People ring me up constantly. Can you help? And as I said, I have spoken many times to the TDs and senators and to specialists, and I've helped get research projects off the ground. All these things are important, you know, and yeah, I will never turn anybody away.
Mm.
If someone rings me up wanting help, I'm there.
And if somebody wants to call you, can I share your number? Let's say there might be somebody listening here who might have Parkinson's symptoms that they might be a bit worried about, or indeed somebody who's recently been diagnosed. Would you be there for them?
I will be, but I want to let you know that there is the national organisation.
I have that, yeah. Parkinson's Association of Ireland, yeah.
Well, it's that's what they call themselves, like on the radio. They're actually Parkinson's Ireland. They rebranded, but they keep forgetting it.
Okay.
So the they've got the Parkinson's nurse. And on the website, there is a number for her.
Okay, parkinsons.ie is the website, and the number is 1-800-359-359. 1-800-359-359. What's next on the bucket list, Tony?
Oh, for me, well, I'm going to go back and see the boss again in Croke Park. in Parky Cree. He's coming to Cork, isn't he?
Yes.
So I'll go and see the boss again. I will, you know, holidays. I'm looking into going to Canada. In previous years, I've been to Canada many times, but I'd love to take my wife there. It's for a lovely holiday.
Well, listen.
So those are things that I will strike off the bucket list.
Keep ticking all of those boxes and keep fighting the good fight.
Neil, thank you very much.
Lovely chatting
with you. And that's for everybody in Cork.
Well done. Well done. Lovely chatting with you, Tony. I wish you well. I really and truly do. Do stay in touch.
I will do, Neil. Thank you very much.
All the best. Tony Wilkinson.
For giving me the opportunity.
Not at all. It's lovely chatting with you. Inspiring to chat with you. Tony Wilkinson. Parkinson's Ireland is www.parkinsons.ie, and the Parkinson's Nurse Helpline is Monday to Friday, 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. 1-800-359-359. Extraordinary, brave, powerful, energetic, and positive man. Back after the break.
The Neil Prendeville Show on Red FM.
Conversation that matters.
Get involved in the conversation, whatever it may be, particularly on the day that's in it today, World Parkinson's Awareness Day. Text 0868-104-106. Big response to my conversation with Billy Keller this morning, and an even bigger response to the contribution from Paul Travaud down in Killarney. I'll get to all of those, but it's cause that matter, lads. And Sarah, thank you so much. I know you've had a busy morning, so thank you for squeezing me in. Morning to you.
And morning to you, and you're the same. You're busy, so I won't keep you.
You're grand. You want to pick up on our... Go ahead. Okay, pick up on our conversations yesterday regarding the state of our hospitals. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I suppose in a background of working 15 to 18 years in nursing homes and hospitals, oh my God, they are good ones. I worked in the Southern Family. They're fabulous. They still are. Brilliant staff, brilliant service. You know, but I've unfortunately worked in ones, and some of them not for too long, for obvious reasons. The care, you can't call it care, really. I suppose talking about an incident that happened in a place I worked, there was a nurse, she's still working there. She was told that she had to work over the Christmas, and she'd been on the Christmas before, and there was war, you know, there was somebody having an operation, she had to work, and that was it. And we got a phone call from the kitchen to say that the trolley, the thermostat in the trolley, there was a problem, that the dinners were just roasting, and to be very, very careful.
You described it as sizzling, bubbling hot food.
Oh yeah, my gosh, yeah. I mean, you know, even through the tea towel holding the ring, they were metal rings that time over the dinners, you know. Okay. The Dubai just stopped the dinners. Boiling, sizzling bubbles, you know, especially the liquidized food, because it's liquidized, so
could be soup.
Yeah, well, the liquidized dinner, say potato, beef, you know, all liquidized in a mash,
okay.
No lumps, you know, for people had trouble swallowing. Anyway, I approached her and I told her, you know, that I'd got the call, and that's what they said, and we all got extra milk, and we were going, you know, telling the people who could eat themselves, you know, to be careful and all that. And she just grabbed the dinner as if to say, you know, don't be telling me what to do, you know. She was in a rage, and she was over to a lady who was non-verbal, you know. She's passing. I won't get upset now, because I was yesterday. And she just plunked the food into her mouth, and the lady, her toes curled, and she nearly levitated her off the bed, you know. And she kept feeding her. And I went over and I said, I won't say the name.
Oh my God, almighty. You know? Oh my God.
And
you went over and said what?
I said, it's sizzling. And I just stopped myself there because I don't want to say her name. I said, it's sizzling, stop, you know. And she wouldn't stop. And I ran to the kitchen. And I got a block of ice cream.
Oh, my God.
And I did my best. I kept feeding the lady the ice cream. And her son came in that evening. Her son used to come in to give her tea. And all her mouth was burnt, and she had cream on the corners of her mouth. And I never said anything. But subsequently, I did. I said it to a few of my friends, nurses that worked there, and they just said, look, leave well alone. We know what she's like. Now, unfortunately, she wouldn't have been the only one.
No, I was going to just say, surely be to God. Yeah. And that is gruesome, what you witnessed. But
that
would be a very, very rare exception. You get an evil person behaving.
Oh, come on. No.
That poor woman, non-verbal woman in the bed. Could you? Because I can. While I can't feel the pain of it, I can certainly, in my mind's eye, get a description of how awful that would have been for any of us.
Well, you could see her palate. If you saw her palate a few days later, you know, crusted and blistered, and the side of her mouth, the corners of her mouth, all red, like cold sores from the burns. I mean, this dinner now was sizzling.
And although you did say it to other nurses, you were told just to leave well alone.
Just to leave well alone. And I went to the manager, the main the assistant director, and she told me, you know, she said, you know, I don't want to be giving too much away, but she said you have a mortgage. She said, I presume you do. I said I do. But she said, look, you're a good worker. Keep your head down. I wouldn't draw them on me. She said, you just do your best. And that's all you can do.
Okay.
And about 2 months later, I left. I couldn't take it anymore, because there was other stuff, you know. You'd be told not to give so-and-so a drink. They'd wet the bed, like the lady was saying yesterday. It would be put in the chart that they had so many meals.
When they didn't.
And you would have nurses at the report at night saying, you know, go easy on the fluids, lads, during the day. So that would be then, some of the care assistants wouldn't give fluids at all, because they'd be afraid in case they did, and the nurse came on duty and saw what was available, you know, as in a wet bed, or, you know, the pad hadn't held the amount of liquid, they'd get it the next day, you know.
They get given out to?
You'd be told there was too much porridge in the bowls. And I'll tell you one story, to get away from, say, that. I was on duty one night with a nurse. There used to be two nurses and two care assistants on. There was a small amount of people, we say 25, and some of them would be well able to, you know, go to the bathroom themselves and all that. And we called the doctor, well, the nurse called the doctor, because a patient was very chesty, wheezing, temperature was bad, all that. And he came and he stood up at the reception and he chatted a while, and he was on about golf and Lanzarote and all that. And he said to her, how long is so-and-so here? We said, Kathleen. And she said, 10 years. Because it was a community hospital, you know. And the lady was in her 80s. A lot of them would have been residents. And he said, do you want any of them to go? Do you want to hang on to them all, he said, you know. And she looked at me. Are you there? Sorry.
Yeah, no, I'm listening.
Yeah, she looked at me and I looked at her and we were like, oh, my God. And he said, look, he said, you know, she's a good age and all that. And she said, look, will we walk down? Come on, will we go down? We'll walk down together. And he said, no, there's no need. So then she said, are you going to write her up for something? And he said, look, see how it goes. Look, if you have a problem, call me tomorrow night because there was no resident doctor there, you know.
What did he mean, though?
Whatever he meant. See how she goes. If she got worse, I think, maybe. So she was getting worse. And eventually it was a day nurse, a day staff, was able to get another doctor who came and woke her up straight away for an antibiotic. And she ended up going into hospital and getting, she threw it in her lungs. But thank God she came
well, what did he mean by, did you say get rid of?
No, he didn't say get rid of. He said, how long do you want them to stay here? Like, how long is she here? He asked her.
Well, what did he mean by that?
Well, my impression was, like, do you want them to stay to stay alive forever? Do you want them here forever? Like, they're old, they're going to die. That's my impression. Impression, I mean, we chatted about it after when we were having our break, you know. We were saying if that was my mother or your mother or my husband or myself. And she was a grandmother, she was a mother, it doesn't matter. She was well able, you know, to greet her grandchildren and, he never even went down, no interest to go down. And he came all the way, a good journey in the middle of the night, 2 o'clock in the morning, to see a patient and didn't even go down.
And what, do you do now?
Oh, I have my own company now. I won't say what it is, because, and it has nothing to do with care, because somebody might will know if they're listening.
But are you still in care, though? But you do it for yourself?
No. Even as a patient, Neil, you were talking about people, you know, that you got good care, or one of your family got good care yesterday. I only heard a little bit. I felt in my past employment, people who... And you're going to say, oh, but you're well known, Neil, you know. So people are going to, you know, give an extra cup of tea to a member of your family. I've seen people who have fallen over, people who, you know, their fathers might be TDs or, you know, the local auctioneer down the road. And then the guy, God love us, in the bed next door doesn't get anything, you know. I've seen all that as well. You know, I've seen all that.
All right, sir. I'll be thinking that poor elderly non-verbal patient being fed.
She's passed. Yeah. Still working there. Okay. I won't call her a lady. She's still working in that place.
Okay, thanks, sir. Take care.
The Neil Prendeville Show on Red FM. Conversation that matters.
On the email of the woman who, with her partner, were escorted by the Gardaí out of the Aviva because some dad complained that they were frightening their two 13-year-olds and they were feeling anxious and nervous and frightened because of the chanting. That lady, who was told she was too loud, is in the right. The ladies' soccer team is telling supporters to be louder than everyone else. It's on TV. You know, show your support. If you told the majority of 13-year-olds to keep it down, and I can imagine what they would say to you. Don't believe a word of that email. They weren't just chanting, come on, Ireland. If that was the case, the whole stadium would have been escorted out. It must have been worse than that. Okay, another one. I had the same in a big game in Dublin. Parents were given out because we were chanting for our team. They even made a complaint to the Gardaí. As I went to the toilet, I was also asked to leave. But when I asked who made the complaint, and was there any violence, the guard had backed down, but only after a while. So not the only isolated people who are asked to leave a stadium for chanting. Regarding the ladies' football email, our Western world is the way it is because people with influence and reach, including you, me, accept and promote ideas you don't actually believe in from a position of misguided kindness or from a fear of being seen as an ism. The truth is, being good and being kind aren't necessarily the same thing. And in fact, there are times when you have to be cruel to be kind. We do the younger generation no favours at all by abiding by their every whim and accepting them as they are with our help and our guidance. They could be so much more if we gave them that help and guidance. Now, imagine you can connect that in some way, shape or form or fashion, Richie, to two women being thrown out of a soccer match. I go to City matches weekly. Lots of screaming, lots of jeering. I doubt if anybody would be removed. And one final one. The woman in the Aviva is sugarcoating her behaviour. She was assessed twice by stewards and then the Gardaí, who deemed her behaviour disruptive enough to remove her from the stadium. She should stay at home, watch the games on television and scream and roar and blow her whistle in her own house, where she is not disturbing other people's enjoyment of the game. It's not the snowflakes, as she called them, that were the problem. She was the problem. Okay, thank you for those texts. Keep them coming. It reminds me, though, did you ever go... I did a situation last night. I was quite proud of her, actually. My daughter was at a film, a picture, the cinema, down in Mahon Point last night. And right behind there were two, I think they were Italian, and all through the film, in spite of the group of people in front of them turning around and, you know, looking at them, you would sometimes turn around and look at somebody that might encourage them to stay quiet. But it wasn't working with these two individuals in Italian. They were just rabbiting away all through the film. And at one stage, even the very quiet, this was a scary movie. So you imagine with scary movies, they're always silent passages where there's no words been spoken. It's for suspense effect build up during a scary movie. They were all the way through it. So she eventually turned around and asked them, please, do you mind? Keep it quiet. We're trying to enjoy the film. That worked in the end, but it wouldn't always work though. You could be ignored. You could be abused. Talking about people that, you know, get grief. My family and I were in Wilton on Good Friday. We parked up. We had to park across two spots as the car next to us did the very same. We didn't want to, but there was no other parking available that we had come across. We parked up, got out of the car. This lady in her car was not just giving out. She was roaring. She was shouting at me. She was glaring at me. She was so loud that I could hear her, even though she didn't have the window down. She was given out that I was taking up two spots. Obviously, it was not our fault, and I was waiting for her to get out of her car, but she pretended to be on the phone. She probably thought I was just going to walk away, but I was waiting. I was waiting to tell her that it wasn't my fault, and that there was no need to roar and shout like a lunatic in front of my children. Some people are just an absolute disgrace. And I really hope she's listening this morning and realises what a disgrace she was that day over that parking spot. And one more of those, because it's busy in this department. I'm at work, but I just wanted to let you know. I was up at Curry's in Mahon Point, 9 a.m, waiting in the car 2 weeks ago. There was a big black transit van parked across from me. I only took notice when a brand new 241 registered car pulled up alongside the black van, driven by a woman with a headscarf. I saw a man in the passenger seat get out, open the side door of the van and get in. He got out of the car and got into the van. There were like six of them, all laughing at each other. I could see all of the duvets folded up inside the van. He got in, then there were seven. And then a woman got out of the driver's seat of the van, waved the woman in the car off, then closed the van door, got back into the van to drive away. The van was a 232 reg. You could see, Neil, that it was organized begging, a group of organized beggars on their way into the city to beg. They must be doing well from the begging, seeing as they were driving new vans and cars. These people are picked up again in the evening, going back home to their council house, given to them for free. They looked, well, this individual actually calls out the nationality of them. I'm not in a position to do that because I can't categorically say that they were who you were saying, but Eastern European, for sure, probably a little bit further. Anyway, the genuine people don't sit around all day as they seek warmth and shelter elsewhere. These fake beggars are taking homes away from the genuine Irish homeless, and it's a disgrace. Also, with regards to the fake beggars, if you look at their clothes, they are spotlessly clean. How can that be if you're supposedly living and begging on the streets? A woman beggar was wearing a pair of UGG boots that cost at least €100. Professional begging and the beggars themselves should be kicked out of the city, says Maria, what she witnessed down at Mahon Point, which clearly was a pick-up and drop-off point for the professionals that we see in our city. Keep them coming. Text 0868 104 106. We've got calls on the way.
Call Neil now. 0818 104 106.
The Neil Prendeville Show on Red FM.
Just very briefly, do you remember I was telling you earlier in the week, if you were listening, about a chap who was suing, I don't know, dozens and dozens of women who said nasty things about him on a dating app called Are We Dating the Same Guy? And I know I was having a bit of a laugh about it at the time. He said that he was suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder for the things that they were saying about him. I did get an email subsequent to that from somebody who wants to remain anonymous with regards to how he came a cropper at the hands of Are We Dating the Same Guy as well. So hopefully I'll get to that email at some stage. But I've got a lot of calls planned and I want to get back to them. We posted up online recently a texter's comment who says, I'm so annoyed. I was in a charity shop. I remember I mentioned earlier on this morning, I touched base on this. Seeing in a charity shop if I could get cheap boots. I saw a pair, same as in pennies. They were €10 in pennies. Yet in the charity shop, they were selling the same boots for €12.50, €2.50 more expensive than pennies is showing them. How is this acceptable? And the pennies want to be new. And there are people struggling. Isn't this the reason charity stores are open? They're getting so greedy with big corporates taking them over, extortionate prices. This badly needs to be addressed. Point being, are charity shops actually charity shops anymore with regards to the prices that they are now charging? There was a big, big, big response to this. And I want to just pick up on a couple of callers on it, in particular Susan, who actually used to work as a retail manager in a shop. Was it a charity shop, Susan? Good morning.
Good morning. Yes, it was.
Okay. So were you responsible for setting the prices?
Unfortunately, yeah. We were in a horrible situation, but what you're essentially given in the chain that I was in was you're given this book, and inside this book from A to Z, you have a list of most brands that people would be fairly familiar with, and you have low, medium and high, so they're ranked in a certain category. So the likes of Pennies would be considered a low brand, and you'd have your Karen Millen then, which would be a high brand. And then you go to another section, and within that then you have, if it's like a Pennies t-shirt, you charge between €2 or €3, depending on the category of shop that you are. So if you're in a high income area, like such as Dublin, in certain areas you could be a shop with a lot of footfall, so you'd be a higher class, you may put the t-shirt at €4. But if you were a lower shop that wouldn't get as much, you'd put the top at €2.
Yeah, but would that be the exception then, that somebody saw a charity shop selling Pennies boots €2.50 than they were being sold new in pennies for?
You see, if they were originally, we'll say, €20 in pennies, but they're knocked down to the €12.50 mark, we're just told to go by the original price. And you're even told if there's a sales sticker on it, if you can take it off to show the original price, you go by the original price, not that it was donated at a discounted price.
Well, a fella, Denise says, went into a charity shop last week to drop in some DVDs. I'd said I'd have a look around when I was in there. I nearly fell to the floor when I saw that they were asking €80 for a man's jacket. 80, not 8. Everything seems so expensive. I thought the idea was to get stuff in, sell it at a knockdown price, keep getting stuff in, keep selling those as a knockdown price.
That was always the idea. Before I even started, that was my thing, is that you were taking on this job to help people who need you. You don't need the customers. The customers need you. So you sell it at a discounted price to help people. You know, obviously you're recycling, which is fantastic, but you're helping people get things at a discounted price, which was the idea of it. But in reality, it's not that. You're trying to make as much profit off that free item that you've received as possible.
And I think that's just
ridiculous.
Yeah, but this could be for a charity that has many, many employees, right up to a chief executive officer, like, and all those wages have to be paid, right?
Oh, they're getting bigger wages than you want to even admit. It's crazy. And then the people who are there, like the managers who may be arguing the point, may not like what they have to do. You're on basic. Like, you're on barely above minimum wage, and the amount you have to do, and all of your, most of your staff, they're all volunteers, so they're not even getting paid. They're on scheme.
Okay. Quite a lot of texts, actually. Now, some of them are very kind, and they actually mention some of the ones that they do visit and get great value for. But others don't. Like, for instance, Heather says, there are staff allowed to help themselves to what they want before they put them for sale. Is there any truth in that, that the staff or the volunteers might snaffle? It's true?
100%. Yep. You see it all the time. Now, an honest manager wouldn't allow it to happen, but the manager has to have a day off. So when the manager have asked, it happens all the time. And in some stores, the manager just doesn't care. Of course, you like it, came out of a bag first. Yeah, you can have it. Some don't even pay for it. They walk out with it in their hands.
But would that be the exception, or is that commonplace?
It's not as common, thank God, but it does happen. Unfortunately, it happens. And there's no way to regulate it, because the regional managers don't know what's coming in. When you're getting a black bag in and you don't know what's in it, it could be good, bad or indifferent. So if you're not there and you can't see it happening, of course, it's just going to walk out again.
Okay, what if, like, for instance, if it's a designer label, that could be clothing or footwear, for instance, yeah?
Yeah, yeah. Now, sometimes, like what I used to always say kind of to my staff, I was very, very lucky when I was there. I had fantastic staff members. But I used to always warn new managers and say, look, be very careful, keep everything, you know, put everything out as you should, don't take chances, because you've no idea. Someone could drop in a bag with like a really expensive dress and testing the shop to see if they're actually being truthful or not. And that's how people are getting caught. That's how managers and staff are getting caught.
Oh, I mean, it's a sting. It's set up.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, because they have a suspicion, they have a feeling. If they're not bringing in as much money as what they should, they'll plant it and see if it's made aware of or not.
It's very competitive then, isn't it? I mean, that leads to another text that says, now charity shops seem to think of themselves as vintage and trendy. And charge accordingly.
Yeah. We were told even if we got Primark or Penny stuff in that was vintage, that we'd sell it at a higher price. And it was only pennies.
Okay, I worked in a charity shop and we got every class of person coming in, mainly buying clothes and books. Most things cost less than a fiver. Sometimes the books were up 150 or less. If we get a donation or something particularly valuable, we try to get a higher price for the charity. Most of the workers are volunteers and work for free. Only the managers get a salary. I don't know if anyone pilfers, but that can happen in any workplace, can't it? All the donations are things the owners no longer want, so they're not particularly valuable in the first place. Cormac has numerous charity shops, so people should shop around if they're feeling they're not getting value. That's probably a reasonable comment to make, isn't it?
I definitely agree on that. But at the same time, there is this thing amongst charity shops, there is competition. Where I was, it was a very small town and there was 4 charity shops. I know it's a lot for a small town. But you'd go into the other shops and you'd be told to see what they're charging. Make sure you're charging competitive prices with them.
But I'd understand that, because if you are representing a charity, you really need to know what everybody else is doing. I mean, Karen, in fairness to her, says, I got a brand new Marks & Spencer's Feather and Down Summer Duvet, still in the plastic, in an undamaged box in a charity shop for €3. But I'm wondering, are those kind of bargains the exception?
Oh, that was a massive, like, well done, congratulations to her. Like, you can get some fantastic, some really, really good offers. I would never down on them. I think charity shops are amazing, and without them, a lot of people wouldn't have clothes in their back or wouldn't be able to put them on their kids. But there is, it's like everything. There's good and bad to everything.
I agree, some of them really need to change their prices. I bought 4 tops in a shop that cost €4 each. A few days later, I was in the charity shop. They were selling one of the same tops, €7.50. There were sweat stains in the armpits on both sides. I said to the girl, is that real? And she told her how much they were in a shop new a few doors up. She said, yes, that's the right price. We have to make money. I said it straight out, that there's no way that someone will pay that for a dirty, sweaty, stained top. Well, I think that'll...
You have to be... It's up to the... Like I said, and you said it yourself, a lot of the staff that are there, they are volunteers, so there's only so much that you can do in regards to getting them to feather out what's good and feather out what's bad. So you will have a few kind of slips through the cracks and you're looking at it going, that's a ridiculous price. That's dirty. That shouldn't be put out. And look, it used to happen to me too, and my staff members, I thought, were very well trained.
So what goes up for sale in a charity shop that other people have worn before, they're never washed, no?
No. They're steamed. So what we used to do, every single item before went out is a steam clean front and back.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. I won't keep you much longer. Just one more for you, because I know you're busy there.
Yeah.
Local charity shop for my daughter. I was looking for gold bangles. I bought a set for €3. The original price was still on them. Brand new, they would have been €4. Well, I would have thought if something brand new was €4, the charity shop should be selling them for €1.50 max.
No, we were always told that if the original price is on it, you're selling it for 70% of the original price.
70% of the original is way too high.
Yeah, so if it was originally a t-shirt for a tenner, you sell it for €7, which I thought maybe like €5 would be more than enough, but no, 70% of the original price is on it.
Okay, covered a lot of ground with you, Susan. Thank you. So are you still in the industry?
No problem.
I actually
left recently. But I loved it. I loved my colleagues. I loved the people that I meet. You meet people from all walks of life, which is fantastic. They are very, very, very good facilities for people to be able to buy things cheap. It's just to make sure that the managers and the people that are running it properly.
No, it's a case. I understand that. It's a case that people are saying that they are no longer cheap.
No, they're not. Okay. They're not. There's no point. And like, they're only a minuscule cheaper than a regular shop.
All right,
so
fair
look.
Okay, thanks for that. I'll let you get on. Thank you, Susan. Okay, you got, as the fella said, you literally have your hands full. Text 0868 104 106. So apparently they have a book with brands and prices, and they follow the book a bit like the motor dealers do in the motor trade. They have a book as well with regards to value of cars and age and mileage and everything, and they consult, or at least they used to consult the book, as was all done online now. Caroline, good morning.
Hi, good morning, Neil. How are you?
You are the chairperson of a charity shop, I believe, for like 40 That's years or something.
Yeah, well, involved in the charity 28 years. The charity shop itself, Balance, is in operation 38 years. So we're based in Ballincollig, just behind the square there by Chapelgate Cafe.
Okay, so here's another one. Daniel says, pre-COVID, I would check charity shops for old jerseys and I'd pick them up for €8 or €9. But now... And in recent weeks, I've seen jerseys that I liked. They were old, but once washed, they would have been fine. Pre-COVID, €8, now €25 each. I put them back.
Yeah. No, and I would understand that. No, I suppose because we're not a chain, Neil, because we, what we do is we fundraise basically for Balance Summer Camp. So our camp runs for 4 weeks of the year, and we fund it solely from the charity shop. So we've no government funding. So the cost of the camp, which used to come in at about 74,000 for the 4 weeks. That would have been pre-COVID. Now, at last year, it came in at about 90,000 to run it for the 4 weeks. So all of that money is made from the charity shop. Now, without the government funding with the charity shop, you obviously have the expenses, we'll say, like the overheads, like electricity. We're still charged city council rates. We've got insurance, employers RSI, and so on. So you do have to run it per
se. Wait, how would you have employers PRSI if the people in there are volunteers?
Now, so what we have is our manager out there is Anne Harrington. She is amazing, and the customers, she really looks after them. You might have people coming into the shop that might kind of say, look, you know, we're looking for X, Y, and Z. And she would say, look, you know, I'll be on the lookout for it. She's had the same customers for the last 17 years. So people are coming back, and they're coming back, obviously, for good reason. So we would be very reasonable in that we don't have a book of rules and regulations. We use our common sense. So we would have a lot of boutiques, and we would have some local department stores. If they have items, we'll say, that they're not, they know, are off the rails, they can't sell them, for uniforms now, for example, we'll say like school pants and shirts and whatever, they will give them to us. And we know then there will be a certain amount of people, and they will count on us to come in and actually kit out their children.
Yeah,
for
and
school.
That's so ideal. Like, that's ideal.
It is ideal. So like this week now and next week, we're having a €2 sale. So every single thing inside in the shop is €2. The reason we do this is to clear the decks so that when we get something in, we won't have it sitting behind in the storage. So that we
but
know
is
that
the €2 sale things people. That you just couldn't have sold at a higher price? But
no,
like, are you saying that could include designer gear?
Yes, it can include, and you'd have to go in to believe it.
Okay.
And the reason
okay.
we do it, it's a very, very practical reason, is because, like, otherwise you could be hoarding stuff forever.
Okay.
You know, so
I
what
understand.
We do is, we do that, but we also do it because we would have people, like, we had a lady came in yesterday. Now she spent €40, which is 20 items, on children's clothes. And she knows to wait for the €2 sale because that means everything to her to be able to clothe her children for the €40.
Things are that tight for her. She got 20 items to clothe her kids for €40.
And this will be normal, Neil. This is something.
Why do you? And listen, I commend you and your manager for the great work that you are doing, exclusively you. But you also say that there's a common misconception that charity shops are cheap.
I'm
part of that misconception then, because I thought that's what that was all about.
Yeah, I suppose, you see, there is a service. So, yes, if we had something that came in, we say like a wedding dress, like we'd get communion dresses and wedding dresses and so on. It would be, now, if we stuck the word, that famous vintage word on top of it, we could charge ridiculous money for it. But we still do want to be able to supply people with something that they can't get elsewhere. But it would be outrageous to think that we weren't going to charge €100 for a wedding dress that might have cost €500 or €600.
I know, I can understand there would be exceptions to everything.
Yeah. So that would be the exception rather than the rule.
Okay.
Now, we would also sometimes gauge like that our customers according to what it is that we feel that they might get on a regular basis. So there is no hard, and staff are amazing. We would have two paid staff. Then we would have people on community schemes, so they would be partially funded by us as well. And then we would have volunteers as well.
Okay.
So that would be the breakdown of staff, we'll say, within it.
All right. Continued success with it. Caroline Miller with Balance in Ballincollig. Eilish, good morning.
Hello, Neil. Hi. That's very funny, because I was just about to say to you that my love of charity shops came from Balance in Ballincollig.
Well, they seem to be doing fabulous work, but I'm just curious, are they the exception? I mean, I'm getting a lot of texts. Claire says,
No.
They are overpriced.
No.
I always went to charity shops. No more. There are people making accusations against the volunteers, pilfering the best stuff.
That's all wrong. Because at the minute now, Neil, I'm on the bus home and I have a pair of beautiful brand new boots. So my pastor got me in Dungarvan for €7, black boots, okay?
Okay.
I have a pair of River Island dark denim jeans, brand new, that I got in as part of a package. I got River Island dark blue denims. I got a Bershka pair of jeans. I got one from Penny's and a jeggings and a fantastic pair of snow boots, white and grey. And the whole lot, Neil, €42 below in Watford City. Okay.
In a charity
both
shop.
Yes.
So you're completely decked out now in all the charity shop gear for
completely 42. And a hat of 25 years old that I got in Germany. Okay. I have a jacket on that my partner bought me. It was originally pennies, brand new, bottle green, €5, padded little waist jacket.
Have you ever gone into? Okay, no, that's fine. And it's all about producing the evidence, and you are. But have you gone into charity shops that aren't cheap or expensive? Are as one texter here said to me, I didn't read it out before, it says, it's just pure business now. It's all about profits and hitting monthly targets. It has nothing to do with charity anymore.
Not at all. Usually the ones I go to are SCP. Okay. Can I mention where they are? No?
Absolutely. I have no problem with that if you're getting good value.
One in Rathcormac. I got a pair of a fantastic SCP shop. I'm always out there. I got a pair of Kate Appleby little ankle boots, okay? Now, they're multicolored with a little fleck of gold sprinkle, and people stop me in the street. I got them. You'd pay about 130 quid for a Kate Appleby red sole, absolutely brand new.
How much?
€10.
All right.
Out of the box.
Okay. Do you ever buy anything new?
I don't know if I'm allowed to. The only thing I would buy new are the ladies' essentials.
Ah.
The little lingeries.
The lingeries. All right.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Thanks, Eilish. Text 0868104106. Lot of comments on this. Back after the break.
Text or WhatsApp Neil now. 0868104106.
The Neil Prendeville Show on Red FM.
I see even more charity shop calls coming in and texts as well, so we'll pick up on those in the morning. Before I love you and leave you, a little bit of a colour story for you. Watching any good television recently? Well, Ripley is absolutely incredible. You should just sit down and watch the whole lot of them. Scoop I watched last night, which is the Prince Andrew car crash TV interview with the Newsnight show on BBC some years ago. It really is good. It's not brilliant. Slightly disappointing. Thought it could be better, but two good shows nonetheless. And there's another one coming down the track soon. I read a cracking story in the Echo during the week that's now going to be turned into a TV drama series. And it's the story of the first female Freemason. It's a great yarn, lads, because I don't know, every summer, so we head into the summer, I give away family passes to go to some fantastic venues all over the city and county where you can take your family and enjoy a day trip. Amongst them are a lot of the OPW websites, and one of them is Donner Ale House. Now, I had the opportunity to do a tour of Donner Ale House with those in charge of it a couple of summers ago, and it was fabulous, the work they put into the home. But the story behind it is a cracking story, and there's a book now that's written accordingly. It's called Donner Ale Court, The Story of the Lady Freemason, and it's written by the now New York-based Kathleen Aldworth Foster. Now, Aldworth is a very interesting name for her to have, because she shares the name of the woman who's the center of the story, the 17-year-old daughter of the Lord of Donnerale, Elizabeth St. Ledger. But rather than me tell the story and spoil it, I'll get the author to do it herself, whose actual background is in broadcast journalism. It's her first book. She joins me by phone. Kathleen, good morning.
Good morning, Neil. Thank you for having me.
Oh, listen, I enjoyed the last couple of days because I did a bit of a dive into you, watched some videos that you've been doing with people and podcasts and things like that, all about this young 17-year-old daughter, right, who was caught up in a situation where it almost cost her her life, right?
Right. If you go to Donnerill, there's actually a placard there on the at the church across the street that tells the story. And it's one of the first times I ever read anything about this part of the story. She was caught spying on Freemasons in the middle of a ritual right there inside, as you called it, Donnerill House, or others call it Donnerill Court. As the story goes, she actually removed a brick from a wall that was under some sort of repairs. And through that brick, she was able to spy on a Freemasonry ceremony. I understand that a lot of people don't understand what this could look like. If you read the book, you might get a better idea of it. But for whatever reason, the men who caught her debated killing her, including her own brothers and her father, the Viscount Donnerill.
She was dragged from where she was into the room. I think the butler did it. I love that term. The butler
did it.
And then they had to wonder, what are we going to do with this girl who saw something that nobody from the outside world should ever see, and no females are permitted? What are we going to do with her?
Let alone a girl. So that's what they were deciding. Should we kill her to preserve our secrets, whatever those secrets might be? So that left me with a ton of questions. What are those secrets? What were they doing? What was so important that even her own father might consider this an option, killing his own daughter?
So he was in, he was up for killing his daughter. This was so serious.
Apparently, that's the story. And it took many, many hours of debate that she had to listen to until one man finally stood up and said, wait, this is crazy. Let's put her through the paces, and let's make her the first ever female Freemason. And as the story goes, that man said, and I will be responsible for her for the rest of my life.
And he did deliver on that. But just before that, so she would have been in the room with the Masons. Mm-hmm. She, from what I read in the book, she would have been blindfolded, sitting there.
There's some fiction in here. I put that in.
She'd have been.
We have no idea. Absolutely no idea what exactly that ceremony would have looked like, what that would have looked like. So, it's a historical fiction. That's one of the liberties I took.
Well, it's 300 years ago. It'd be hard to get everything accurate because everything isn't documented. But she did become, her life was saved by becoming the world's first female Freemason.
Yes. And what's interesting about that is that there are other women throughout history after her who have done similar things. Their curiosity just got to them, and they had to see what their husbands and fathers were doing. They were caught, and they were put through similar ceremonies up to the point of what they saw. But what makes Elizabeth so interesting is that she didn't stop there. She kept coming back, and she was an active Freemason for the rest of her life. So much so that when she was buried under St. Finbar's Cathedral there in Cork, she was given a full Masonic ceremony.
We're jumping to her death. I'm happy to go there and fill in the blank in the middle. When St. Finbar's then was being renovated, many, many, many years later, I'm not sure how long later, but would it have been 50 years later, 100 years later?
I think it's about 100, yeah.
So 100 years when they're renovating St. Finbar's to build the one as we know it, they had to disturb her grave.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And someone said, hey, let's pop it open. Let's take a look at the Lady Freemason. And it is recorded that she was in a state of perfect preservation her clothes, her skin, everything was perfect. Now, if she had been Catholic, we would be saying, ah, she's a saint. But as we know, she was Protestant. And then she was reinterred after that.
That's extraordinary, isn't it? Isn't that extraordinary?
It is.
So she did, her saviour was a guy called Richard Aldworth, who was in the room at the time. He'd come over from Newmarket to Donnerail for the initiation ceremony of the Masons. He said that he would take responsibility. I have a terrible dislike for her father, I have to say, that he would even suggest that his daughter would be put to death. But Richard married her. And what did she do with the rest of her life?
5 months later, yes, the two of them got married, and she moved into Newmarket Court, also right there in Cork. The same architect who did the renovations on Donnerill Court actually built Newmarket Court. So what we know about their life after that is that they had two children together, one of which a son named Boyle, who inherited Newmarket Court. And the second son, whose name was St. Leger Aldworth, he ended up inheriting the Viscount Donnerail title. They created it again for him, and he inherited the Donnerail estate. And he then changed his name to St. Leger. So if you look now at the genealogical line of the Aldworths, I mean, of the St. Legers of Donnerail Court, they are technically Aldworths.
So the Aldworth connection piqued your interest, because you also are an Aldworth and probably knew that you had Irish roots. So you thought you might be related to the central figure of your story, Elizabeth St. Leger Aldworth.
So I grew up in Philadelphia. My Aldworth family settled in Philadelphia in the early 1800s. Aldworth is a British name. So I grew up believing that whoever these Aldworths were that were my ancestors must have been British. I didn't know until years and years later, when I was in my 30s, that Elizabeth Aldworth in this branch actually came from County Cork, and so did mine. They are distant relatives. So I would be a very, very distant relative of her husband, Richard Aldworth, that dates all the way back to the Bristol, England area. His line came, they were the more wealthy branch of the family. We are the more poor branch of the family. We came through Bandon. But yes, that connection is there. And it is because my great-grandmother was also named Kathleen. Her name was Kathleen Aldworth. And do you want to know the story then about how I first found out about the Lady Freemason?
I think I would be interested. I think you were in Giza with the pyramids or something.
Yes, when I was 25, something told me to go to Jerusalem for Christmas 1999 and make the journey to the pyramids of Giza for Y2K, the Y2K New Year's Eve. No one would go with me. I tried to find any friends to go with me. No one went, so I went alone. And when I was there, I met a British man. I remember his name was Mark. I can't remember his last name. And he told me that I shared this Aldworth name with the first ever Lady Freemason. I didn't know a lot about Freemasons at the time. I was very interested in learning more about my Aldworth family. So he sent me a book in the mail, The Hiram Key. And that was the first book on Freemasonry that I ever read.
And at what stage did you travel to Donnerail Court? Because I believe when you did, it certainly wasn't open to the public, and it was in a fair state of disrepair.
No, and it was wonderful that the OPW actually let me go in. But that was so the first time I went to Ireland was in 2006. I was on a family trip, another genealogical trip. I had a great-grandfather from County Roscommon who was an early member of the IRB. So I grew up. I was taught to hate the people in the big house because that's who, the family that I knew. He'd be rolling over in his grave if he knew that I wrote my first book about a big house family. But when I arrived in Shannon Airport, I was telling my dad, you know, I just found out that Lady Freemason I told you about was from County Cork. And the man my dad had hired to drive us around said, yes, not only, you know, was she from here, but her house is still standing. Do you want to go? So he took us straight to Donnerill Court, and there we were standing behind a chain link fence looking at the house. It was boarded up, and he was the one that told me that story that I told you earlier about
but
how
you
she
were,
was
caught. Yeah, but you were back after it was renovated and opened to the public, weren't you?
Well, then I came back in 2013, and before I came, I asked the OPW if I could get inside, and they allowed me access for about a week. and they gave people to me, to the gardener at the time, a man named Mick O'Sullivan, gave me tours of the ground. Inside, I met a woman named Sheila O'Hanlon there, who was working in the tea rooms at the time, and she took me through the house and helped me imagine what it would have been like in the exact rooms, and helped me with some local history as well. So that was in 2013. Then I started writing back at home. I also had been in contact with David Butler, who is the archivist and historian at Freemasons Hall there in Cork, for Munster Freemasonry, and he was instrumental in the research of this. And the two of them, Sheila O'Hanlon and Richard and David Butler, stood by my side essentially for years as I wrote this story.
And you were back, of course, to see it in all its splendor, because it is so beautiful now with all of the work that went into it. And that's a gorgeous thing, to see the house vibrant and open again like it is. So that's wonderful. So so we're talking about an event, the early 1700s, that's now going to be made into a TV drama or a mini series or something like that.
The production company that's efforting this is named Great Island Productions. They're based right there in Cork. They focus on stories that take place in Cork and can be produced in Cork. And what they want to do is to create a 3-season series based on this story that I wrote, and also plans that I had for a second and third book will now be adapted into a second and third series. Then it will examine her life, as you'd asked, what she did during her life after this initial night up to her death, which was in 1775. And around that same time came the American Revolution, and the American Revolution was spearheaded by Freemasons. So I'd love to take a look at her life and what she would have possibly done. You know, these are the parts of the story that we might have to make up. Just to tell the story.
That happens. That becomes very acceptable. Certainly something that's over 300 years old. So a TV series to look forward to. Not quite sure when, but certainly it's in the planning process, right?
Yeah, it's a long road to go, but there is a screenwriter who actually lives right near me here in the New York City area. She's a professor of screenwriting at Fordham University. So she is currently working on the pilot script. And once the pilot script is done, then the guys in Ireland, their names are Jim Robinson and Mark Kenny, they will start using that to try to get some funding together, and then eventually start having meetings with streaming networks, and we'll try to sell this. And I think it's a perfect time for a story like this to be on television. But for me personally, I love the show Outlander. Outlander only has another half of a season to go, and then the 8th season is going to be its last. So people like me are going to need something like this to watch.
Yeah, and you also have to speculate as to who you want to play the leading lady's part.
Yes, that's a part of the process that they're going through right now. They're focusing mostly on Cork-based actors.
That's fabulous.
To see who this must mean a lot to the people of Cork. And we're hoping that actors who are from Cork will be interested in taking part in this program.
Okay, we'll watch this space for details. It's a great, great story. Can't wait to see it in film or on TV as a miniseries. For those that might have their interest piqued, you can pick up a copy of the book yourself. It's called Donnerill Court, The Story of the Lady Freemason. It's a pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much. I hope I didn't get you up too early this morning, but what a great yarn. Do stay in touch if there's any updates with regards to it.
I will do, Neil. Thank you.
Okay, look after yourself. Take care for now. Cheers. Kathleen Allworth Foster. Great story. Watch this space for details, as I say. Oh, just finally, Tony Wilkinson's on, who lives with Parkinson's, but he battles on. He says Parkinson's hates him because he works so hard to keep it at bay. He spoke about Smovie Health, able to help him to live with Parkinson's. Well, tonight, for those of you that might be interested, there's a free webinars online, obviously, 8 p.m. on how to learn to slow the progression of Parkinson's. And Irene Tracy from Smovie will host the event. You can register to be part and to watch the free webinar tonight, www.helpingpeoplewithparkinsons.com, because today is World Parkinson Day. Have a good day, and I'll see you tomorrow.
When Cork talks,
Cork people blow my mind.
They talk to Neil Prendeville
on Red FM.